When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Germany podcast. I'm Travis Dow.
And I'm Steve Guerra from the History of the Papacy podcast.
That's right. Today is a special episode because I have a guest co-host, or rather, we're both guest co-hosting each other's shows because this will also be on the History of the Papacy feed. And the reason we got together today is because we have to cover some common ground here. And that is basically the conversion of Germans from their Germanic paganism, which I spoke of on the last episode, to Christianity. And that did not happen overnight. That did not happen that did not happen to the same brand of Christianity, let's say. And it becomes central to many aspects of the future of the history of Germany. So it really makes sense to pause and slow down and take stock again and really take a look at how this happened and how Germans converted, some of them really quickly, some certain tribes, and very early, actually, at the same time as many of the Roman citizens were converting. And so let's take a look at how that happened. And the earliest conversion, let's say, and what also gives us a great example of converting to Christianity among the Germans, is a Goth known as Ulfilas. And I'll let Steve take it away on who he was and why he's actually pretty important to the history of Germany.
Ulfilas, commonly known as Wulfilas. That's the one name I use the most.
We can go with that. Yeah.
He was a Goth, possibly a Goth. His background story is a little interesting. He was born in the early 300s, 311-ish. But his parents, that's the trickier part of the story. During the late 200s, bands of Goths were going into the Roman Empire and raiding and taking slaves back to the northern part of the, just outside of the Roman Empire, around the Black Sea area. Now, Wulfilas possibly was a half Greek, half Goth. The thinking is that his parents were actually taken from the eastern part of Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. And so he was maybe a second-generation Greek or half-Greek, half-Goth.
Yeah, it's not sure. Yeah.
But so when he was growing up in this northern area, the Greeks really held on to their Greek identity, and they were Christians. He had some form of Christianity, but at this point, too, the Goths were integrating more with the Roman Empire.
Right.
And he went back into the empire and became a disciple or a follower of a really important bishop named Eusebius of Nicomedia. There was like 50,000 Eusebiuses at that time. This is different than Eusebius of Caesarea, who wrote a really famous church history.
Okay. Yeah.
He was a big-time Arian Christian, Eusebius of Nicomedia. We should probably
I was just going to say, and let's be careful here, because I think most people know. I always think that my listeners, or I always expect them to be pretty bright and know these things, but just because we are talking also history of Germany, we're talking about Arian Christianity here, as in Arianism, like nothing to do with the Arianism of Hitler, but like no connection at all, nothing. Historically, completely different things. One is from the teachings of Arius of Alexandria and has nothing to do with Nietzsche's Superman or some, you know, Nazi idea of anything. And this is actually what takes them apart is basically Arians believed in, and there are some sects of Christianity today that still believe this, by the way. I think it should be pointed out. It's kind of interesting. But they don't really believe in the Trinity, like the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, but rather that God is above all, and you know, Jesus is actually created. He is the Son of God, granted, but he is lesser than. And we'll, you know, we'll break this down when we actually get to Wolfie Luss's views a little bit. But yeah, just to define Arianism, that we're talking about Arian Christianity as in Arius of Alexandria, and not some kooky Nazi concept of, yeah, you know, exactly. Nordic Arians. And, you know, the other one doesn't even make any historic sense. And I will break that other one down when I get to the Nazis eventually, which, you know, might, at this rate, it'll take me like a decade to get there. But yeah, just so it's clear that we're not talking about that. We're talking about Arius of Alexandria and Wolfie Luss being an Arian Christian.
And Wolfie Luss, just to get that out there too, it's thought to be a Gothic word for little wolf, which is interesting. Right. I never read anything anywhere if that had any significance or if that was just his name. It's a cool name, at least.
Yeah, it sounds like kind of a barbarian Gothic name. Come here, little wolf. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah.
So these Greeks who lived north of the empire, they kind of went back and forth between the Roman Empire and the Gothic lands. I think that was another thing when I was doing research for this. I didn't really before understand how porous that border was and how integrated the two societies were.
Yeah, even just thinking about that, Wolfie Luss grew up, you know, learning Latin and Greek and Gothic, which, you know, that's great. I mean, just bilingual like that. And so obviously, there must have been some kind of communication back and forth. And yeah, it is interesting, actually. So it's not the Roman Empire, and then across the Danube are these, you know, horrible barbarians that will kill you and murder you on sight. They did do border raids and, you know, captured slaves, and there was that going on, but there was also a lot of trade and commerce and Gothic mercenaries and, the whole nine yards. It was a very porous border, like you said, I think.
And Wolfie Luss, I think, is most important thing that I think of him is that he was at just a perfect time. The Goths were really... they were absorbing a lot of Roman culture, and Christianity at that point was really the next step of becoming more Romanized. And so them becoming the Goths, becoming Arian Christians, was a series of events that was just a perfect time at a perfect place. And it would have a huge impact for really centuries later. And it's just because of this certain set of circumstances and a very narrow window of time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is. Yeah, especially Wolfie Luss and the Goths' conversion is interesting because, it happened so early. It's almost, you know, it's not all of the Romans were Christianized yet. It wasn't, it was still living memory of persecution, or there would even be persecutions yet to come, I guess. Another thing that's important to mention is because this is happening so early in church history that the Roman Empire wasn't solidly one church with, you know, as we know of them later, as a solid pope in Rome, and it's always been like that. This was so early that there was a bishop in Rome, but there was also a bishop in Constantinople and a bishop in Alexandria, and there was a fourth one, wasn't there?
In Antioch, and there was one in Jerusalem.
So those are the five main? I thought there was like four, but yeah, I guess it depends on what time in history too, but yeah, so, you know, this there wasn't a pope leader. But yeah, we have Antioch and Jerusalem, and those bishops are kind of equals, I guess. And so you can't say, like, when we say Orthodox or Catholic Church, at this point, it's interchangeable. This is before the schism. Catholic is the Latin word for universal. Orthodox is the Greek word for universal. And at this point, but what we are saying probably is that they were a Trinitarian Christians, like they already believed in the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, all being aspects of God,
and all equal, the same,
exactly.
there was generically a divide between the Latin West and the Greek East.
Oh, right.
That was a political and a religious break that was happening. And obviously that split would have a lot of different aspects to it and history as we go along. But that's something to kind of keep in mind. And that these Goths were more so in the Eastern sphere at this point than they were in the Western sphere, even though they're going to have a really big impact in the Western sphere very soon.
Yep, that's true. Their brand of Christianity was more Eastern. Yeah, and the religious differences within the Roman Empire, like with the Greek East and the Latin West, at this point, yeah, the religious differences. But yeah, the bishops fighting for power, it's kind of more of a political thing. And the religious differences were there, but not regarding the Trinity necessarily. There was a lot of other points that would then, you know, later be brought up in the Councils of Nicaea. But
liturgically and language use. And that was something that was happening all throughout the empire in various different ways, that there was really an Eastern part forming and a Western part of the empire forming that were in a mode that they're separating.
And for the Arians or Wulfilas, in fact, Wulfilas himself, because he was also a priest and he had something to say. And so we can actually get a glimpse of, you know, his own teachings of Arianism and what he believed. And it's, I thought there were some interesting points in there, kind of because he's a Goth. But basically his version is that God the Father was unbegotten, like he's not created. Jesus was the only begotten God. So really high regard, however, less important than God, who was just always there, you know. And then the other thing that, because the Holy Spirit is even honestly a little tricky for me, like theologically or philosophically, to figure out exactly what's going on there. But Ulfilas also acknowledged the Holy Spirit because it's, you know, it's in scripture. He kind of says it's neither God nor Lord Master. It's not something that you would worship as part of God. It's just, it's a thing that exists. Yes. But it's just an aspect of God or something that God does. Not in any way equal to God or, you know, the Son, Jesus.
And the theology of the Holy Spirit really won't even be completely figured out until a council at the end of the 300s.
Yeah, I think, to kind of get that down and pin down the definition of what the Holy Spirit is and the ramifications of the meaning. That would take a while. What I thought was interesting, and this is, is it a quote from? No, it's something from Ulfilas, but I was just kind of wondering, did they maybe grasp Arianism because they were just closer to a part where that happened to be spreading? Was it just happenstance? Or did Goths gravitate toward Arianism because it was a starker version of monotheism? And because Romans were pagans as well. But I was just kind of wondering, like, is there any reason why pagans would go to one rather than the other? And I don't really know, but Wulfilas was very adamant on there being, you know, being monotheistic, there being one God. And part of that makes me think that, okay, so that's why he gravitated toward Arianism and, you know, maybe to shed his pagan roots as much as he can. But who knows? That's just, you know, kind of a thought that I had.
I think there's a couple of things going on with that. I think there's a very good chance that the Greeks who he was descended from had a more Arian worldview or a subordinationist worldview.
So the Christians that he knew just happened to be Arians, and he never even necessarily heard the other viewpoint until he was already done and converted and, you know, had opinions of his own. Right.
And having been a student of Eusebius of Nicomedia, who was the big-time Arian or subordinationist, that was a huge part of it too. So I think that given everything, it led up to him being very starkly Arian. And I think, like you said, there may be some aspects of Goth culture that kind of lended themselves towards having a more that stark difference that there's God the Father.
Yeah.
Boom.
Maybe Romans needed that transition. You know, they said, well, you know, the pantheon, they had, there's fathers and sons, and this is all normal. So why wouldn't there be a Trinity? You know, who knows? The Germans and Romans tried very hard to smooth the conversion in many, many ways, and often in slightly different ways. So it's just, you know, a thought that kind of popped up is like, hey, I wonder if there was a theological reason or if it just happens to be the missionaries he ran into. But it's interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely something to think about.
Yeah. I know in your podcast, you talk about the Council of Nicaea. I guess it must also be... and Gary Stevens' podcast. I've only heard a few episodes of his, but I really liked it. So I don't want to cover the whole Council of Nicaea here, or the Councils of Nicaea, but this was one of the major sticking points of the First Council of Nicaea, was the whole, you know, what is the nature of the Father and Son and the Holy Spirit? So,
in really broad strokes, Arianism wasn't that popular. As far as what the thought was at that time, there just weren't that many of them. And so that put them in a weaker position going into a council where Constantine wanted to come out of the council with one viewpoint, even though Constantine himself, in his own personal opinions, went towards more of an Arian belief system. And that's going to set where we go with Goths for the whole rest of the fourth century, is that the emperors and the sons of Constantine are going to be leaning more in an Arian position, even though the Orthodox Catholic is going to be the official position of the mainstream Roman Church.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, but that is interesting too. That does kind of have an impact on history and events. So another thing that's interesting to point out is, I did found one, or I don't know if you wrote this or if I wrote this, but that possibly, and I can't remember whose idea this was or where this came from, but Goths might be predisposed to Arianism because it's more, God is kind of, could be more seen like as, or maybe Goths liked aspects of the Old Testament God better, you know, warlike and, you know, going out conquering and securing the Holy Lands, that kind of thing. And chiefs, the Germanic chiefs or Gothic chiefs might have associated with that all-powerful unity, unitary God more. That's one thing I came across. Another one is that important to point out is that while Wulfilas was Arian, not all Goths were.
Mm-hmm.
So in this, there were some that were Catholic, or, you know, slash Orthodox, whatever, or Trinitarian. I wrote down somewhere the technical term. It's like
Homoousius. There's several different.
I don't know where I wrote that down, but yeah.
Arianism was one type of subordinationist, where Jesus and the Holy Spirit were subordinate to God the Father, and so they all had slightly different beliefs. Mm-hmm. And there was one belief that Ulfilas may or may not have had, that Jesus was kind of like God the Father. He wasn't exactly like him, but kind of.
Yeah.
And then there was another strain of it that was Jesus was completely created and completely lesser than God the Father.
That's the more radical view of the spectrum of things, right. Yeah.
And so that was another reason why Arianism had a hard time, especially in things like the councils, where it was a consensus building and a voting. When you have one position has about five or six different opinions going against a majority group that has basically one opinion, they had a hard time getting any traction.
Mm-hmm.
There was a big diversity of opinion amongst the subordinationists, and they were going up against a group that had a tighter viewpoint.
Yeah. Yeah, which makes sense, because one set of beliefs lends itself to the whole spectrum of, well, if Jesus isn't equal, then what is he? You know, mm-hmm. and the answer are basically infinite. From he was a mere mortal to, oh, he was like 99% God.
Yeah.
And whereas, yeah, the Trinitarian Church could just say, well, you know, he's equal and done. It's, you know, we've answered this question. Next. So
they blow apart in about 100 years from there, where they have their own set of opinions that diverges into an infinite spectrum, basically. But at this point, they were able to keep more together because they were going up against something that was starkly different. At this point, you have two really starkly different viewpoints.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, much later in history, you see Protestant churches splitting up over how often to take communion. You know, because the Bible just says do it regularly. So, yeah, ouch. Yep. Yeah, as soon as you get a, if something's hard to define, then, you know, that could create problems. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it did create problems. This was a whole part of the Arian controversy. Wulfilas was, you know, right there in the middle. Goths living so close to otherwise Orthodox or Catholics, basically, created, you know, added to the controversy. And, this is something interesting to note that that the Goths were kind of in opposition or kind of contrasting those around them. And if we put this in the broader context, among the Germans, so Goths were Arians, but some of the later converts then really came from, or even not just the Roman Empire, but even from Anglo-Saxon missionaries would come back to the Germanic tribes on the continent. And that's interesting. But then that brand of Christianity, because that happened centuries later, then it was just pretty much straight up Catholicism. And if the missionaries happened to come from the East later up, you know, through the Slavic lands, then it was just Orthodox. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so in this time, so later, I don't know how much to talk about this on this episode because I'm going to bring them up more thoroughly again later. But the Franks, for instance, were converted to Catholicism, and you know, like Saint Boniface is a great story because he's, you know, an Anglo-Saxon missionary that comes down into the, you know, the continental Frankish Empire basically and starts preaching. And then later we have the Saxon conversion by the Franks in turn. And there's, you know, wars fought, and that's a whole other interesting story, which I'll get to in future episodes. So I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I just want to make sure that because we're spending most time on this episode talking about Goths and Arian Christians, that we don't, you know, generalize too much and say, okay, so that was the Germanic tribes. Germanic tribes were Arian Christians. That's totally not true. So in fact, the Germanic tribes that we today associate with parts of Germany, let's say, or as more, you know, more recent memory, instead of Visigoths and Ostrogoths and Longobards and all those, we do have like the Franks and Saxons and Frisians and all of those. Those were much later, and those were Catholic.
Yeah.
So, yeah, interesting. Just kind of important to note. But so let's get back to Ulfilas, because I'm kind of getting ahead in the timeline even. There's a couple of interesting things that we should mention with, you know, in Gothic time frame and even back to Ulfilas.
So with Ulfilas is coming from that Eastern tradition. In the East at this point, there was more of a focus on translating into the native languages of the people outside of the empire who they were trying to proselytize to. Where in the West, it was more of a Latin focus. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of different reasons for that. The East being maybe more cosmopolitan, you had Copts and a lot of different groups who were becoming Christians, and so it was probably a lot easier to translate. But so Ulfilas created a Gothic alphabet kind of based on Greek and modifying it as necessary to meet the needs of the Gothic language. And he eventually became a bishop to the Goths. That was another thing outside of the Roman Empire. Amongst groups, they would have bishops to an entire ethnicity, maybe you might say, instead of Ulfilas wasn't the bishop of a city as such. He was a bishop to a people, mm-hmm. being that there probably wasn't, in the Roman sense, a real city for him to be a bishop of.
That's a good point. Yep, yep.
At least by Roman standards.
There were villages, yeah. But I talked about a lot of these kind of aspects in the last episode when I was talking about the Gothic or Germanic paganism, is that villages didn't happen until much later when they start to kind of settle down and emulate Romans. Not to say settle down. They weren't nomadic, but they didn't live in villages either. They kind of had farmsteads. So yeah, you couldn't be a village, a bishop of, you know, city name, insert city name here, because there were no cities. And the other thing that's interesting that you just mentioned is he created the alphabet. Mm-hmm. That is both horribly interesting in history. I love alphabets and that, you know, the history of alphabets and that kind of thing. But also unfortunate, because the Goths had just started to kind of figure out runes and just potentially write down their pagan history. But that didn't happen really, because they converted so quickly. They, mm-hmm. you know, right around the time when they're getting into runes, Ulfilas comes along with the alphabet, and that's that. And then from then on, it becomes Christian history and Christian writings, and they try to shed their pagan past. So, you know, kind of when I was researching the Germanic paganism, I was actually a little mad at Ulfilas, even though I think his alphabet's pretty cool, you know? So.
Yeah, and I think from your last episode made me think a lot that they were not nomadic people in any sense of the word. They were really right. forced to move on
That's
mass.
That's a misconception later on in history. Right, yep, yep, exactly.
And so they had a lot of civilization structures in place.
Yeah, by this time they did have villages for sure, yeah.
And I had read someplace that archaeologists have found villas and Roman-type buildings right on the other side that were a little bit different. They were emulating mm-hmm. that Roman culture and that Roman structure.
Yeah.
But so back to Ulfilas again, back to Ulfilas. Yeah. He created this Gothic alphabet, and then he wrote a translated version of the Bible, which is interesting. He actually cut out a few pieces of the Old Testament, again, that he thought were maybe a little bit too warlike. Again, that might be that might be a little another thing that in later times that they brought in there. The Bible as such was still kind of a floating thing at that point, and so books were coming in and out, so that could be a possibility. That's a little bit less fun of an idea than mm-hmm. that he cut things out that were too warlike.
Yeah, interesting thought though. Yeah. Huh.
So he ran in afoul of one of the chieftains, Gothic chieftains, and so he basically picked up his whole Christian flock from north of the border and wound up settling in modern day Bulgaria in the city of Nicopolis ad Istrum, and he lived out his life from there. He engaged to some degree in some of the debates that were going on, but I think the rest of his life was really built on getting these Goths Christianized and building up his particular flock.
Yeah, and another kind of interesting thing that you can actually go and look up is that his alphabet is not at all the same as like the Gothic font that you think of today necessarily. It is more based off of Greek and that sort of thing. But we do have extant kind of sources or pieces of that. And if you want to go Google this or look it up, I'll probably put a picture of it up on the History of Germany podcast.com and probably on the, you know, A to Z history somewhere, but, mm-hmm. or on we'll Facebook it if not, but the Codex Argenteus, which is in Uppsala in Sweden these days and has been since the 30 Years' War actually, which means I kind of think I know where it was before. But a parchment page of this Bible was found in 1971 in the Speyer Cathedral. And so you could actually, you can go online and take a look at that original, you know, Ulfilas' Gothic alphabet and see what that looked like. I think that's pretty cool.
And then I found some more stuff on liturgy and mass. Well, I didn't find anything, but it was an interesting it was interesting looking that up, because they're really, the Goths used an Eastern, more Greek flavored liturgy, or that, at least that's what they think. But there's clues. I think that's a big part with a lot of Gothic history in general. You have to just find clues of what might have happened. Mm-hmm. So much, much later, the Goths who settled in Spain used a really particular mass, and they think that that mass that they used had elements of it that went all the way back to maybe original Gothic features of the liturgy.
Yeah,
and I just, okay. And throughout time and for a lot of different reasons in the West, one mass kind of took over. And I think to some degree, it's the mass that's with revisions is used today. So it mm-hmm. kind of homogenized in the West, and that all went away. But it actually stayed in Spain a little bit longer, even because of the Islamic conquest. They
right.
were
okay.
The Christians, yeah. The Christians in the Islamic parts were kind of doing their own thing.
Exactly. Yep. That makes
for
sense.
A lot longer. And then the Christians who didn't get conquered, or whatever you want to call it, by Islam, they more integrated in with what was happening in the rest of the Latin West. And mm-hmm. just something interesting. I'm sure that will come up at some point, either in either one of our podcasts.
Well, on a similar note, and this is something that I still really need to do some research into, is I'll bring it up again. But, you know, when the last time I talk about the Goths, I will also bring up the Crimean Goths. Mm-hmm. But I think religiously they've kind of dropped everything. But you know, the thing is that people don't really know, because they were basically gone by the 1900s, or gone by World War II, let's say, for sure. And they were kind of marginalized. But they still had a Gothic branch of Germanic language that was still spoken, and all kind of, you know, well into the 18th century. And so that kind of makes me wonder. That made me wonder too, I wonder if their mass looked any different, or if they just went to the local Ukrainian churches, but they had their own communities. So, but unfortunately, not a lot is known about them even. So
I think that's just a theme with the Goths in general. A lot of, they became marginalized either by their mm-hmm. own actions and developing into the cultures they were with, or because they were minorities in a much larger culture that also marginalized and pushed some of their unique views to the side. They definitely flavored the cultures they were in, but they were just such a small part of where they would eventually wind up. A lot of they were uniquely got lost.
Right. That's another thing I'm going to cover is the traces of Germanic, but especially if you talk Spain, like Gothic, and traces of Germanic things still left over, like in, you know, the last name Rodriguez, or mm-hmm. I mean, there's just hundreds of examples, but I'll actually go, you know, look for those and kind of put them together, because I think if you do look, or if you know what to look for, they did make an impact in you know, dozens of small ways. So which are interesting, including like the mass you just mentioned, which might have, you know, lasted into the Middle Ages. Just all kinds of little things. So I will have to come back to that and say, oh, okay, this certain cultural thing of Spain, well, it's actually Gothic or whatever. So
yeah, it's definitely one of those things. Yeah. Once you know what to look like, it's, oh yeah, that's definitely. Mm-hmm. And then one other tiny thing aside, that especially if you out there go and do a little bit of Googling, or you want to find out more, the Gothic architecture of the 12s and 1300s, maybe as early as the 1100s, has really nothing to do with the Goths themselves. Right. That was a pejorative term for a new type of architecture that was very different than earlier forms of architecture.
Right.
So, and like you said, Gothic script as well.
Yeah.
Doesn't really have much to do with these Goths.
Yeah. 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 If you say Gothic alphabet, I don't mean the font type. If you, you know, like, yeah, yeah. No, I mean like the actual alphabet, which is more like Greek. It might be more like there's a bunch of those alphabets. The you know, like when Cyril and Methodius mm-hmm. came through Bulgaria and created a Slavic alphabet, and then which is what all the, you know, Russian is based off of, and all of those modern alphabets. But there was a lot of in-between stages that people don't really think about. And those were often liturgical, like religious languages, mm-hmm. and used in, even today, it's interesting that, I'm kind of getting sidetracked here, but it is interesting that if you go to a Romanian Orthodox mass or wedding or baptism or whatever, it's interesting that some of their liturgical words, so Romanian is a Romance language. It's one of the only, it was, for instance, the only Romance language that was under communism, that was under the Eastern Bloc. But so that's kind of interesting. But they're in their mass and their religious rites, the missionaries didn't come from Rome. They came from Constantinople. It was, you know, Cyril and Methodius came through their lands. And so there's some certain words are actually from Slavic, from Bulgaria, and not Latin in mm-hmm. their mass. When Romanian, it should be all from Latin because they're also a Romance language. So there's a lot of, when you get to the Orthodox branches of, you know, like Bulgarian and Romanian Orthodox and Russian and Greek, then you see a lot more differences and a lot more of, you know, from a lot earlier age, everything was in the local language and that sort of thing. Very ritualized, just like in the West, but a different sort of evolution. So, yeah, it is interesting.
Similar,
to kind of point
but a little different.
Yep.
I think we have your next project lined up, the history of the Slavs.
Oh, man. That's...
You ready?
That would be an interesting one. Yeah, well, there's Bohemian. But yeah, there's so much that we don't talk about because it's not just Czech specific. There's all kinds of topics that are more akin to like Pan-Slavism or Cyril Methodius coming up, you know. They mm-hmm. that impacted, you know, a huge chunk of the globe actually, but because it's not Western Catholicism, we don't give it as much thought. There's a lot of interesting coming up for sure.
Yeah. So now we're starting to get into the next phase of Germanization and the Romans and the Germans coming together. And that next phase, when we were moving beyond the Goths are still there. Don't worry about that. But what we get to is a really important group of Germans, the Franks. They don't become Arians. They actually convert to Orthodox Catholic Christianity. And I think Travis is going to speak much more to Clovis in the history of the Germany. So I'm definitely looking forward to
Clovis
that.
Clovis will have his own episode for sure, probably as a way to kick off the Franks. There's a lot more coming there.
So that's really going to be the game changer, that a really extremely powerful group of Germans is going to come in on the Catholic side as opposed to the Arian mm-hmm. side. And that's going to set the stage for this next couple of hundred years leading into Pope Gregory the Great in the late 500s, early 600s. He bridged the gap between the Romans and the Germans, the barbarians, if you will. He was really a guy, too. He was steeped in Greek culture, too, but he didn't seem to really like it that much. He didn't seem to get along with the Greeks as much, even though he spent a lot of time in Constantinople. But when he came back and became the Pope of Rome, there was really this power balance between Constantinople and the West, and Gregory started to form this new hybrid Romanized Germanized thing that was he probably wanted to be as a power balance against Constantinople. Also, Gregory was really important to the re-Christianization of Britain by Christianizing the Anglo-Saxons, who right. will go ahead and in turn go back into Germany proper and help to Christianize their Saxon brothers who still lived on the continent.
Yeah.
And they will also help Christianize the Vikings, who will also have a big play in the country of Germany proper's future history.
That's right. The Vikings will come back to the history of Germany for sure. Oh, yeah. So that's another interesting one. In fact, I mentioned in the last episode, I also had to talk about Vikings and Norse religion and Anglo-Saxons, because there was just a lot more, because they were pagan for so much longer, there was a lot more written text. The Norse actually wrote texts in runes. Instead of using runes like divination or, you know, carving them on lots, they would actually write with them and create poetry and all sorts of things, like especially Iceland is known for this. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, we get a glimpse of the old world, which means, yeah, even when I was talking about Germans, I had to, you know, they didn't write much down. So I had to, you know, compare to much later conversions. So of course, yeah. So I talked about the Vikings a little bit last episode. They will come back in a big way in the history of Germany when they start basically, you know, invading every village on every river that they can get to.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Okay. And another interesting thing to note is that the missionaries didn't just go after, you know, people that spoke Latin or Greek or the Goths. The missionaries really kind of fanned out in every direction they could from the Roman Empire, and also just, you know, by themselves in the East. And including missionaries went off to preach and evangelize to the Scythians and Persians and many other, you know, quote unquote barbaric groups. So it just to kind of, you know, put that as a note, I would say that Goths weren't the only ones. Goths were, you know, in a context of larger efforts to convert barbarians, I would say. It's just important to note.
And the Goths, they didn't go away completely, but they were always there. But along with the other Germans, the Franks, when they came into the former Roman Empire in the West, they were a minority group that formed the aristocracy. So in a lot of the places where the Goths went, they formed the aristocracy and worked in conjunction with the Catholic bishops. So at this point, the Germans, for the most part, I guess the word you could say is they played nice mm-hmm. with the majority population who were Roman and Catholic.
Yeah.
There were some persecutions, but for the most part, the theme wasn't that these Aryan Goths were trying to convert the mass of the population. It wasn't functionally feasible at that point.
Mm-hmm.
They were the overlords, making sure that everything ran smoothly amongst the population. And yeah. One of those things wasn't to tweak the noses of the population.
Right. Well, the point you just brought up about, Catholic Romans, maybe even grasping for Aryan Goths as a way to kind of form a coalition against Byzantium. And mm-hmm. You just mentioned that might also go the other way, that when these Goths came in and started conquering Catholic lands, that they also said, well, we better play nice with the locals because, you know, we still need allies against the mighty Byzantine Empire right
yeah.
next door. So yeah, that actually could have worked out for Aryans to just, you know, be as peaceful as possible with their surrounding Catholics and harmonious as they could, which is not a picture you often would get if you think of a word like the Vandals or the Goths.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's exactly what happened. They actually tried to be peaceful and not upset. It wasn't a revolution. It was just quietly, filling the order that already existed with their
own
people.
As a successor state.
Yep, exactly. Yep.
And that kind of leads into a really what was left of the Goths. And really, there's very little actual artifacts of what the Goths. But one really cool one is in Ravenna in northern Italy. That was the capital of really of Italy at that point.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Gothic church, Gothic in the version of the Goths, not the later Gothic.
Right.
Church of Saint Apollinare. Nuovo, and there's some really interesting mosaics in there that are kind of hard to see. If you look up that church online, and maybe that's something we can also post some pictures, the mosaics show a very different iconography than what Trinitarian Christianity shows. Like, for example, they show Jesus as a young man, beardless, and then as the mosaics progress, they show him in more of an older light where he's maybe looks a little bit more worn down by life, showing that Jesus is a creature.
Right.
And he
ages. He's not immortal. Yeah.
Showing his humanity of going from a young man to right before the crucifixion. And interesting, in some places I've read, the mosaics are a little cruder than, say, other more Roman mosaics. They're just not as well done.
Yeah.
But it's really cool that that's survived. And now it's just a regular Roman Catholic church. But there's a baptistry that has a lot of Aryan elements to it as well. So it's cool that there's just right under the surface a lot of really interesting things there.
Yeah, I'm just looking up the Google images of it, and that is pretty cool. Yeah, architecturally, it's just a regular Romance. What is that style? It's not, you know, not Roman, but
Romanesque.
Romanesque, it's because it still has the arches, no longer a vault. It has a flat ceiling like you would then see in early medieval architecture, but it's clearly not Gothic, you know, Gothic architecture in any way. It's definitely trying their best to emulate. Yeah, there's a half vault in the front with the mosaics.
And
they're trying to emulate the Romans as much as they can.
And that was the place where the Germanic Goths attended. And there was another church in Ravenna that the name escapes me right now. That was the main cathedral for the Catholics.
Right.
And they each went to and did their own thing.
Yeah.
And somewhat of a harmony.
St. Apollinaire Nuovo. If you know, if you're listening to this right now and you happen to be in front of Google, it's pretty cool. The mosaics are pretty neat.
And I think a big thing that we've been saying, the Germans are kind of Germanizing the Romans at this point, and the Romans are Romanizing the Germans. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of back and forth going on. There was major growth in papal authority at this point, which is going to have a lot. And in my podcast, the relationship between the Germans and the papacy is going to be a big thing that's going on.
Uh-huh.
And at this point, like in the 500s, technically Byzantium is in control of the city of Rome, and therefore the Pope of Rome is under Byzantine control.
Mm-hmm.
But they're going to constantly be fighting to try and get out from underneath that control and exercise their own power, which they think they rightfully have.
Yeah.
So they're going to work with these Germans to kind of create their own power base and identity in contrast to the emperor and patriarch in Constantinople. You know, you kind of have a coalition going on there against this Byzantine Eastern successor to the Roman Empire.
I do think that's kind of an interesting way to put it. It's kind of a, you know, common ground, a coalition against the Byzantines who are kind of domineering the empire as a whole at this point. That I think that's a good way to look at it. Like you mentioned that, it is also in the history of Germany in my own podcast. I was watching some documentaries. There's a series in German about, I don't remember if it was about Saxons or Germans or if I'm confusing several now, but you do see that, you know, the big dynasty, the Otto the Great or Charlemagne, at some point they end up in Rome. You know, at some point they're either groveling for forgiveness or being, you know, crowned emperor by the Pope. And it's this relationship that eventually becomes known as the Holy Roman Empire. But it starts way before that. And it has, you know, it is a thing between German kings and Catholic popes from day one. Inseparable. You can't really have one without the other.
And I think, did you mention it in the history of Germany, or if you haven't, I'm sure it's coming up, the House of Welf, or Welf, W-E-L-F.
I haven't mentioned it yet, I don't think.
That's going to be something that affects the papacy and Italian politics up until the 1600s. So things that are happening right now have like 1,000 years where they're still playing out.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very, very fun time in history. I think it's not ancient history. It's really modern history is getting made right now. Mm-hmm. Well, right now in the 500s, right now.
Yeah, exactly. The ramifications are felt forever. They've changed they've changed history. They've changed the timeline. We now feel the things that happened in the 500s. Absolutely. Yep. That is interesting. And there has been some work done in kind of trying to look at this Romanization or Germanization of each other, let's say. And Eugen Weber, or Eugene Weber, did some work on this and are, you know, looking at how the groups kind of started to intermingle and then influence each other and synthesize and, in the end, turn into a whole new culture. And the beginning of this process, I will talk about in the next episode. On the history of Germany, I want to talk about the Romanized Germans, like what that looked like. And again, it took centuries, but there's a very clear difference between the beginnings of Roman contact with Germans, which I've already covered a couple times, and then, you know, the Germanic invasions, where Germans almost look the same as Romans once they actually start to settle down in the Roman Empire. So it's really interesting how, and then it becomes something new again. You know, the two separate cultures create something that did not exist before, and it kind of, you know, something that we think of as, you know, dawning in the early Middle Ages and that sort of thing. So we'll, you know, start to get into that next episode.
And if we're wrapping this up, in conclusion, for the Goths and for these Germans, Christianity, I think of it as a killer app. Niles Ferguson, the Scottish historian, he wrote about six cultural ideas that explain why Western civilization took off in the 17th and 18th centuries. But I think that Christianity's sort of the Roman killer app, where these outside of the empire groups who really wanted in, Christianity is a way for them to plug in, and they could get into those communication lines and the learning and the communication and the trade networks. That was a really easy way for them to get to turn from outsiders into insiders.
Right. Yep. Yeah, I put a note there that it was like a USB hub, because it was just universal. Everybody could communicate with that if they started to learn Latin or in some cases Greek or whatever, but started to you know, look at Christianity, and then they would just have more in common with the merchants they're coming in contact with, or, you know, if they're mercenaries, the people that are hiring them, and all kinds of benefits and things that really made it appealing to you know, everyone in the end. But yeah, really interesting stuff.
And as these Germans and Goths were coming into the Western Empire, they really helped to prop up the cultural and the societal structures and the governmental structures of the Western end of the empire that were crumbling. And they maybe they're part of the reason why the West went into what you might call a Dark Ages. I think a lot of people would argue with that.
I hate that term.
But that learning changed in the West. And it went away from what the Byzantines and the Eastern Greeks and what the later Islamic groups, they carried on that more classical learning, or where the West was going in a different direction.
Yeah, it's undeniable that right after the invasions, there was clearly a decrease in learning. I mean, no one can argue that. To say it was a Dark Ages, because when people say the Dark Ages, they think it lasted for centuries, or it's the same as like medieval, which that just all really gets my goat, because we have things like, like you said, from History of Alchemy, for instance, that podcast wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the Islamic commentators that kept all that Greek knowledge alive, you know? Mm-hmm. But also, yeah, like the monastic copying of the Bibles and the monasteries, and even the later examples in Ireland. But then we have the Franconian Renaissance, the Saxon Renaissance, the 11th, 12th century Renaissance, all before the actual Renaissance. So a lot of those are in the supposed Dark Ages. So, but yeah, of course, before, it took a while for the first universities to be set up, and, all that war and destruction, The scholars were probably the first to get it, or at least try to leave. Brain drain scenario. The Dark Ages is harsh. You can't say that.
Yeah. The West, the Latins and the Germans said that, oh, learning sucks, so let's not do that anymore. Economic output really bottomed out in the West, and without that economic output, that was the thing that kept the Greeks in Byzantium going, and that they were able to continue learning, and the Islamics, they had economics that could support all this scholarly business, where in the West, trade dried up, a lot of things dried up. They were a lot harder hit with the fall of the Roman Empire than the East was. So there you go.
That is true. Yep. Yeah, the East would be stable enough to last for another 1,000 years, which no matter how you spin it or look at it, that's saying something. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't get crushed by the Huns. They didn't get crushed by the Goths. So clearly, they had their act together somewhat. It's interesting. I am going to do an episode on when I finally get to the early medieval period. I'll do a whole episode on inventions that happened during the quote unquote Dark Ages, and bring up. Well, there was advances in philosophy, like at least in terms of like theology and all sorts of smart thinkers, not only thinking but even writing stuff down.
Yeah.
And then things like water mills and Anglo-Saxon irrigation and all that kind of stuff will have to come back. But I think for now, we've kind of covered our conversion. One thing I want to mention is that both of us are members of the History Podcasters Network. So we, highly recommend. There's collages out there that we've all collaborated on and done. The latest one, one that's coming out soon, actually, is End of an Era. Mm-hmm. And I think you're on that one. Yeah, I'm on that one. Yep. So that one's coming up. Otherwise, go to, find us on Facebook. What's your Facebook page? A to Z History?
Yes.
Yeah. And A to Z History, a history of Germany for me. And find us on Twitter. You're also A to Z History on Twitter, I believe, right?
Yes. And everything, all the links to that can be found at my website, a2zhistorypage.com.
Yeah. Okay. So there's, links to Twitter, Facebook, all that stuff. Otherwise, thanks for listening. And whatever feed you heard, if you heard the History of Germany, definitely give History of Papacy a listen. And if you were listening to the History of Papacy, stop by. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I've had a ton of fun. I hope you guys enjoyed this too.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.